Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Joe Rathman. Ryan Nisley is at the board. Of course, wondering what I'm going to ask him today. I know it's always a little nerve-wracking what I'm going to open with, isn't it, Ryan?
It's always an adventure, but it keeps me young.
It keeps him young. He's already young, so you're going to feel like a teenager then today, right?
Hey, cool. It's like a Benjamin Button kind of a situation. I like it.
Yes, exactly. Well, today we're actually talking about kids and how they say things that really cause us to pause or to take pause. I remember a show that was on when I was growing up that was called Kids Say the Darndest Things. And it would have all kinds of little things that the kids would say that just where you're just amazed that they're so wise at their young age. Do you ever experience that?
I absolutely do. The wisest thing I think I can recall a young person saying to me was when I worked in my last job in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and there at Life 96.5, and I was in a fast food restaurant, and a young man recognized my voice while I was ordering my food, and he said, "I know you. You talk on the radio." And I said, "Hey, thanks. That's very sweet of you." And he must have been about 10, 11 years old, and he said, "You're weird." And that was it.
It was insightful and wise beyond his years.
That's right. They have a lot of wisdom in there, and they express it in a way that can be essentially particularly amusing, I find.
Yes, it's true. In fact, just a few days ago, my 9-year-old came up with something that was particularly insightful. I was lamenting to my husband at something that a person had said to me that was really hurtful. I didn't know that he was listening. He was kind of sitting on the couch playing his DS, so I didn't know he was paying attention. And all of a sudden, he pops up and says, "Mom, why don't you just tell her that she hurt your feelings, and then she'll forgive you and you can hug?"
Oh, my word.
And I thought, If it only it were that simple, but maybe it is.
Maybe it is.
Maybe it is that simple. So kids say things that are amazingly insightful for their age. Actually, the Bible has something to say about it. I know you'd be shocked, or maybe you're not. But Psalm 8:2, it says, "God ordains the strength out of the mouths of babes." And then in the New Testament, not to be outdone, Matthew 21:16 says, "Praise comes from the young." Mm. So praise comes. And I find that too, that they're just so able to praise and so able to not think about what that conversation may hold for me and this other person, but instead looks at the results. Well, it's simple, Mom. You just ask for forgiveness, then you hug.
There's an innocence in that, too, mm-hmm. because they haven't encountered situations which have jaded them, and so they still have that, as it's called, childlike innocence, and that is so fun and so refreshing.
And childlike faith, of course. And we're going to talk about that today because my guest for today has written just a fabulous book, very insightful, called Small Talk, Learning from My Children About What Matters Most. And the author is Amy Julia Becker. She writes about faith and family and disability for Parents.com, the New York Times Motherload blog, the Atlantic.com, the Huffington Post Parents page, Christianity Today, and the Christian Century, and numerous other publications. Her first book, A Good and Perfect Gift, Faith, Expectations, and a Little Girl Named Penny, was named one of the top 10 religious books of 2011 by Publishers Weekly. And Amy Julia lives in Western Connecticut with her husband and 3 children. Amy Julia, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Joe. It's so great to be with you today.
Well, it's great to be with you, too. And I told you over the phone as we were kind of chatting about the show that many things that you said made me laugh and cry because I've experienced so many of those conversations as a mom. And yet you added this element of thinking about how your faith was affected based on what your children said. How did you come to that realization that, hey, maybe I could write some of these things down and they would make a good book?
Well, in part because I'm a blogger, I was writing some of those things down along the way. And a friend eventually said to me, "You know, I feel like one of the things you do for me is you help me to see that even in these littlest moments and statements that our kids are making, you can make some meaning out of that. I wonder if there's a book there." And so I started thinking, well, gosh, if I were to take different themes and topics that our kids have asked a question about or that they've made a statement about and thought about what God has taught me through those questions and statements, what would I come up with? And pretty soon a book was born, and it was really fun to just put all these different topics and then think, you know, how do I structure these together and tell a story of parenting and of God's faithfulness to me in those years, especially the early years of parenting.
Well, so tell me what was going on in your years of parenting when you wrote this book. What were the ages of your children?
When I was writing the book, I started about 2 years ago. So at that point, my oldest daughter, Penny, who has Down syndrome, was 7. And William, our son, would have been 4.5. And Marilee, who's our youngest daughter, would have just turned 2. So right now, they're all about 2 years older than that. But that was when I was writing the book.
So it seems like when I'm reading the book, there's like this mix of positive and negative emotions that even within a day or a morning, you get this mix of positive or negative emotions, especially raising 3 children. Why do you think that parenting does that to us?
Well, I think in some ways it's a very true experience. And so as a result, you go to those real places, those real emotional places of sorrow and anger and guilt and shame, and on the flip side of that, of true joy and wonder and laughter and beauty, and as you said, and grace. All of that can happen within an hour, if not even a shorter period of time. But I think it's because there is something so real that happens in those relationships. In some ways, because of exactly that interaction with your son that you described, because kids don't have the filters and they don't have that jadedness of knowing that they're supposed to not be, you know, having a tantrum, and they're also not supposed to giggle so much, right? Like, we have all these social conventions that keep our emotions in check, and some of that is great, but some of it means that we tamp down on who we are, and I think our kids, in both the good and the bad, kind of explode, and we get the giggles and the laughter and the wonder, but we also get the tantrums and have to find ourselves as adults in the midst of all of that.
Just this morning, my same 9-year-old, I was writing down just the intro to, you know, how to introduce you, writing down your bio and things. And my 9-year-old says, "Mom, why do you wait till the last minute and to get your work done?" And I said, "Well, I wouldn't have waited till the last minute, except that you're off school today and I have to take care of you." And he just looked at me and I thought, isn't that funny that here's the topic we're talking about today, is that our kids say things that it's really just an innocent question. And he would expect me to say that to him because I know I've uttered those words before as he's
trying to
finish his homework and shove it in his backpack and get on the bus. And so he turned that right around and said it to me. And I just found it funny when I got in the car. I just started laughing out loud because there it is again. He says something that makes me think about my own behavior in a very different way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That certainly happens to me all the time, where my kids ask very innocent questions about things I'm doing and I have to figure out how I'm going to honestly explain it. Or they point out, you know, "Mom, you say that I'm not allowed to be looking at your phone. Why are you sending an email right now?" Or, you know, whatever it is. So they call us out a lot, I think.
So that's probably why I loved your chapter on failure, because I thought, oh, I've been there. Oh, I've been there too. I've been there a lot. And probably any parent can say that. And you just tell a great story about failure, talking about your daughter's first experience with tennis. And any overachiever, striver, which is probably most women, can really relate to that. Can you share a little bit of that and what lesson you learned about failure?
Sure. So I am an overachiever in a kind of classic sense, and I think a lot of moms are. And so whenever I was unable to be as domestic as I thought a good mom was supposed to be, I felt like a failure. So I felt like a failure as a gardener, and I felt like a failure when it came to Halloween costumes and any number of other things. And then there along came a summer, and our daughter Penny, who at the time was probably 4 or 5 years old, wanted to take tennis lessons. And Penny has Down syndrome, so she's smaller than other kids her age. It takes her longer to respond to a ball coming across a net. She's never taken tennis lessons before. So she was insistent that she wanted to do this. My husband and I were worried that it would just be a bad experience for her. And what was so amazing was she insisted, so we've let her go out there. She's doing tennis. The other kids are bigger than she is. They've played tennis before. They're, you know, hitting it across the net. They're doing everything right. And I watched her do it, and she probably hit the ball 1 out of every 10 times it came across. And I'm wincing and thinking, oh, my gosh, even at age 4 or 5, I think this would be a really hard experience for me. And she came off the court that day and she said, "Mom, I hit the ball," which she had done. And she was able to see that as a success instead of counting the number of times she had not hit the ball. And that meant that she was excited to go out and play tennis again the next day, whereas I would have probably been a crumpled mess at that point. And it was such this wonderful little example of how to have a positive attitude, how to keep going, how to persevere, how to take risks, and how to therefore ultimately learn something new. And I was so proud of her, but also kind of in that, I was amazed by her ability to have that attitude instead of that self-critical one.
So raising a child who has Down syndrome, and I loved reading about your interactions with her younger brother, William. What have you learned most of all about the experience of raising Penny? That's
I've
a loaded question.
I've learned so much from raising her. And I think most of all, I've learned about our common humanity. I think when Penny was first born, I did what I think a lot of people do, which is I saw her as though she was almost in a different category because she had Down syndrome. And one of the really sweet gifts of having her in my life is to recognize that there aren't different categories for people. And sure, we can put names to our racial backgrounds or to our economic status or to our, you know, genetic conditions. But ultimately, what it means to be human is that we are limited. We can't do it all, and that's not a bad thing. We're fallible. We have lots of moral failures, and we need grace in that place, and we are loved by God. And that's, I think it's so, it's such a simple truth, but Penny's disability has really helped me to believe that that is true, not only about her, but about myself as well. And I've seen the ways in which she's limited have helped me to see that about myself, seeing the ways that that she is so beloved and such a gift has also helped me not only to see that about myself, but about pretty much everyone I encounter, to trust that they have a place where they need things from other people, but also that they have something to give. So, I think Penny's just changed the way I see human beings. And I think she's given me a much more godly perspective on that. And I'm so grateful.
Well, talking with Amy Julia Becker today, she's written a fabulous book called Small Talk, Learning from My Children, about what matters most. We're going to chat with her a little bit more when we come back about faith, family, and disability as well. If you would love to see a copy of her book or have a copy of her book, maybe you think you have something in common, I bet you do. We have a few copies that she has generously donated. Just give us a call if you have a question or comment or would like to get a copy of that book at 877-933. Faith, 877-933-2484, or you can go right to myfaithradio.com. You can click on the Connecting Faith show page, and there's a spot there where you can enter in a question if you have one but don't want to say it on air, and we can get your question on the air that way as well. We'll be right back on Connecting Faith. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. Thanks for joining us this afternoon, talking with author Amy Julia Becker today about her book, Small Talk, Learning from My Children, about what matters most. She's also written a great book, A Good and Perfect Gift, Faith, Expectations, and a Little Girl Named Penny. And Amy Julia, you write about Penny in your chapter on beauty. And, oh, this just so resonated with me because as busy moms who are trying to raise our kids to the best of ability, be a great wife as well, work hard at the gifts that God has given us as well. And then there's this thing called like staying beautiful. And that seems to get pushed by the wayside. Even staying healthy sometimes gets pushed by the wayside. But you write about just feeling like maybe you weren't feeling your most beautiful, and yet your daughter Penny just kind of changed that around for you. Tell me about that experience.
Yeah, this was a moment that I will never forget. I had William, our second child, was probably 6 months old. So I was kind of far enough away from giving birth that in my mind I should have, lost all of my baby weight. And I was looking in the mirror about to go out to dinner. And Penny was sitting on the floor next to me just paging through a book. And as I was looking in the mirror, all I could think were negative things about my face, about my body, about all of those the weight of kind of worldly expectations on how I was supposed to look. And I just had a sinking feeling that it would never be good enough for my own, you know, my own standards. And as I'm standing there, looking in the mirror, Penny happens, and she has no idea what's going through my head. She happens to look up and say, "Boofle, Mommy," and go back to her book. But it was such a gift of God's grace for her to say that at that moment, because I knew she said what she saw, right? I mean, she looked up and she saw beautiful mama. And it made me really start thinking about what do I really believe about beauty? Do I really believe that beauty means I need to go to the gym for a couple hours a day and use lots of anti-wrinkle creams and, you know, have expensive clothes or something like that? Or do I actually believe in the kind of beauty that God talks about and that his word tells us about, the beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit? And I started to think about the ways in which I see Penny as beautiful and to recognize the ways that love is involved in beauty, and that's the kind of beauty I want to have in my life, is the beauty that comes from love. And certainly it doesn't mean I want to not be, as you said, healthy or like not take care of myself. But that wasn't what was going on when I was looking in that mirror, you know. And Penny really spoke truth with those two such simple words to me. And again, this was years ago, but I will never forget it. And I still try to hold on to that and to that simple understanding of beauty that at the same time I think is really profound and profoundly different from how our culture sees beauty.
I remember snuggling with my oldest after I'd had my youngest, and it was, I don't even know how much after I had had my youngest, but it was the same thing. I'm thinking, oh, I should be back where I was, but I'd lost a significant amount of weight, and my older child crawls up in my lap and he goes, "Mommy, you're not soft anymore."
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, I don't want to be soft." And he kind of burrowed his head in my chest and he said, "I like you soft."
Oh, that's so
I
great.
Wrote that one down because I thought, well, I'll have to keep that in mind because I never think of me wanting to be soft. So
right. It
was just kind of funny. And it's true. I don't know why women do that to ourselves, but we certainly do. And I wish it could change to see ourselves the way that our children see us. And that certainly makes us see ourselves the way that God sees us as well. So love that chapter. And I've noticed in just reading the reflections that you had that a lot of times you're trying to teach your children something, and yet we don't seem to be able to do that thing that we're trying to teach our children about. And you wrote about gratitude as being one of those, to say thank you when you mean it, to say thank you to God as well. Can you talk more about that and how you've just learned from your kids how we should act in that way?
Yeah, I mean, certainly one of the things that all grown-ups are doing with their kids is teaching them to say please and thank you. It's a kind of an unending refrain. And our kids have picked up on that, Penny in particular. And so one of the things I was struck by was how insistent she was in that stage in her life. She still is, but not to quite the same degree of, like, if we're in a restaurant, she wants to go back and find the waitress and say thank you. And if we're in, if she's taken a class, you know, a ballet class, I think is the example in that chapter, she wanted to say thank you. And I was just struck by the fact that there's so many times in my life where I don't make the effort to say thank you, whether it's, you know, I've stayed at someone's house and I haven't sent them a gift to say thank you, or I haven't written a note, or I just don't take the time to say thank you. And it certainly happens as well as a parent with my husband. And I think some of that is, I forgot, or I didn't take the time to say thank you when he was with our kids. But some of it is a sense of entitlement that I think can easily creep into our lives. That sense of, I don't know if I need to say thank you for you being spending time with your own children. And yet, you know, there is, cultivating gratitude in our lives is part of what enables us to see God as the giver of all good gifts and to acknowledge how many of those gifts we have every day, even if they're very simple. And cultivating gratitude also helps us, like, admit our need for other people and that we can't just control and get through our lives on our own. And so Penny's willingness and kind of insistence upon saying thank you all the time was really this convicting experience for me of saying, okay, why am I not saying thank you all the time? And what is it that I'm unwilling to admit about myself in not doing that? And so trying to just practice gratitude, to literally say, okay, what are you thankful for? You can always come up with something and a lot of things usually. So that was another area where my kids, I think, really taught me, even though I was trying to teach them.
Well, and I remember writing out thank yous even after Christmas, and one of my children said, but Mom, I never get a thank you from them. And I said, well, do you want them to be sitting at their kitchen counter and say, I never get a thank you from them? No, of right. course you don't. So let's send the thank you.
It's great. It's great. But, and yeah, I can.
Sorry. And imagine if we were talking about that with God, if we just decided we were going to stop saying thank you. It just,
Right. And it's interesting, too, because it's not only that God truly deserves our thanks, but also that I think we should say thank you because it's true, right? But there's also something positive that actually happens in us when we are humble enough to acknowledge what we should be grateful for. There's something, I think, that's really beautiful that comes of that in our souls. And so it's not only that we should say thank you because we ought to be thankful, but also because some joy that comes with that when we recognize how much we've been given and how much of our lives we don't deserve, and yet how gracious God is to give us the good things that we have.
That is well said. And it does seem like that is a lesson that we are continually going to be teaching our kids about, and that we have to continually be reminding ourselves of as well. It never ends, does it?
No, definitely not.
I keep thinking that parenting will come to an end at some point in time, but I realize that my parents are still parenting me. So I'm thinking that that is not going to happen.
You know, my mom, her youngest daughter is about to turn 30, and there are four of us, and she would definitely agree with you. It just keeps going.
But it's a gift, too. In fact, I keep telling my mom, well, you'd be so bored if you didn't have the four of us continually messing up. I mean, you would be so bored. Who would get to hear your wisdom if it weren't imparted to your four children all of the time?
Absolutely. That's great.
Sometimes I'd like to be a little bit bored, though. Well, today I'm talking with Amy Julia Becker. She's written a very insightful book called Small Talk, Learning from Our Children About What Matters Most. And she has great chapters in here just about regular things that go on in our lives, things like kindness or talking about tragedy, talking about love or laughter, and how kids help us not only have a good insight into who we are, but have a wonderful insight into who God is as well. We do have a couple of copies left, and we'd love to get one of those into your hands. Just give us a call at 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. And if you have a story you'd like to share about something insightful that your child has said that has helped you kind of see life or God a little bit more clearly, we'd love to hear that as well. Or if you have a question for Amy and Julia, I'm sure she'd be happy to answer those as well. You can submit those on MyFaithRadio.com. Through the Connecting Faith show page, or again, you can just give us a call at 877-93-FAITH. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. I'm Joe Rathmanner, and very happy today to be talking to author Amy Julia Becker. She's written a great book called Small Talk, Learning from My Children About What Matters Most. And several of the chapters in here involve just everyday conversations we might be having with our children, but how they help us to learn a little bit more about ourselves and how they help us to learn about our faith as well. And one of these chapters, Amy Julia, that I loved is the one on forgiveness, because I feel like we are constantly in this chapter in our lives. Either one of the kids has said something that has hurt another one, or I've said something to them. And I'm going to read this this just short little quote that you wrote and then ask you to reflect on it.
Sure.
You say, this time I'm ready. You're telling your children what the definition of forgiveness is. And you say, it means that even though someone has done something wrong, you won't stay mad at them and you won't try to make them feel bad about doing something wrong. It means you'll be friends with them again, even though they hurt you, just like God forgives us and loves us, even though we do wrong things. And that is just a stroke of brilliance. I'm going to write that down and put it on my mirror so that I can explain what forgiveness is. How did you get to the point where you had to explain what forgiveness was to your kids?
Well, it started when William and I got in a fight over putting his clothes on in the morning, which is how many of our mornings started the year he was four. And so we went back and forth, and at first it was a little bit funny, and then I started getting annoyed, and then he threw his pants, and then I threw his pants, and then he threw his pants again, and then I threw a pillow at him and knocked him over. And it's kind of funny when I look back on it, but at the time it wasn't funny at all. And he burst into tears, I think more because, my anger had hurt him than the pillow. But I finally, you know, I went over and I hugged him, and I'm feeling that sense of, oh, I can't believe I just lost it on my 4-year-old. And he's weeping and saying, I just wanted your help putting my pants on. You know, and I said, oh, William, I'm so sorry. Will you forgive me? And he looked up at me with his big brown eyes, and he said, Mom, what forgive mean? And, you know, he just didn't even know the concept. And the first thing I said was, it means it's okay between us. And he went on with his morning, and I don't think he gave it another thought. But I spent the whole day thinking about, well, wait a second. Forgiveness doesn't mean it's okay. I mean, it's not okay that I yelled at you and that I was angry and that I knocked you over with a pillow. And I don't want to teach you that that behavior is okay. So what is forgiveness really about? And I spent the day just thinking about forgiveness and about how there's really dramatic forgiveness. I mean, certainly like Jesus forgiving the people who are killing him on the cross. And we have lots of examples of people who are asked to and called to give that kind of forgiveness. But forgiveness in my life is in these very daily moments, as you just said, of the kids yelling at each other, or the mom yelling at the kids, or the dad, you know, coming home late from work, or the mom forgetting to pick up the dry cleaning, or whatever it happens to be. We have to forgive ourselves in these very small ways all the time. And that, it was thinking about that kind of domestic forgiveness. And what does that actually mean, that I finally came to that place of the quote that you read, of recognizing that it doesn't mean it's okay, but it does mean that you are going to choose to be friends again and to not hold this against me. And that is what God has done with us, for us in Jesus. And so that little interaction with my son just brought me to a deeper understanding of God's act of forgiveness for us, but also of what it means to live that out in our family day after day after day.
Speaking of listening to what God has to say to us, I just kind of chuckled as I was reading how to explain to kids exactly what it means to have been forgiven, why mm-hmm. Jesus had to die, what the resurrection is all about. How have those innocent questions that came from your children helped you to better understand what God is trying to teach us through the Bible?
Yeah, I love the questions they ask, and they are often, they ask the questions that I have, and I don't even sometimes realize that until they push me. So when our kids were asking me about Easter, and I truly very much believe in the reality of Jesus's work on the cross and his resurrection from the dead, and yet I also think there's a reason we call it a holy mystery, because it's really hard to explain. And it's not only hard to explain to my kids, it's hard to explain to myself. I mean, how did this actually work? What does it actually mean for sin to be forgiven through the death of this one person? What does it mean for a body to become alive again? My daughter Marilee asks me all the time where Jesus's body is. And I'm like, well, it's alive. It was ascended into heaven. She's like, but how can it be a body if it's in heaven and not on earth? Good question. I don't know. You know, and I do think it's fine for us to admit to our children that there's some aspects of our faith that are mysterious. But they also have pushed me to really have to clarify, what do I believe? Why do I believe it? And how can I explain it to them in terms that are simple enough for them to understand without me only telling a half-truth about whatever it is we're talking about. And trying to explain Easter is certainly one of the biggest challenges, but also something I deeply want them to hear about and to know about a little bit anyway.
I remember trying to back up from that conversation and say, well, you know, the Bible writes about this system of sacrifice, and, you know, here's what people used to have to do. And then they're like, you mean they had to kill animals? And then I'm like,
know,
oh, wait, we're going honestly. The wrong direction. We're going the wrong direction. So I'm constantly praying, God, show me how to teach this lesson because I'm not doing it well.
Yep.
So it does.
But I do think one of the things I've learned is that showing our kids that we don't have all the answers and that we make mistakes, that we need forgiveness, all of that is ultimately, I think, part of what God wants for us, you know, in helping them to learn what it means to be human. Even when it comes to these spiritual matters, and it's not to say there are plenty of answers that are out there and available to us, but there are other things that are mysterious or that we just don't know. And I think it's good for them to recognize that too.
And I'm noticing that as my older child, he's 12 now, he's starting to ask a lot more intense questions. And where I mean, we were just having a conversation yesterday and he's like, Mom, you did a lot of things wrong. And I'm like, yes, honey, moms do things wrong as well. And that was difficult for him to understand because I don't know what they think of us, obviously, that we don't do things wrong. But it was kind of neat for me to realize, oh, my goodness, what is it that you think of me that I have never done anything wrong? You know, yes,
right.
We do things wrong. And I need to ask for forgiveness just as much as you do and learn those lessons as well by doing things wrong. And he was kind of shocked by that conversation.
Absolutely. Actually, this is funny. Our daughter, Marilee, who's 4, so I guess she's cluing into this a little earlier with me. But she, the other day, I said something. I was like, Marilee, I'm not perfect. And she was like, you're not? And she was shocked. I mean, and William came over and he's like, Marilee, Mom is not perfect. And so he backed me up. So at age 6, he's clear on that. But I do think that's something that, you know, kids assume that the authority figures in their life are perfect. And again, we want them to feel safe and secure and like we know, you know, have confidence in their world, and having us know what we're doing is helpful for in that. But at the same time, having them know that, yeah, we don't have all the answers and we've done lots of things wrong, I think can be helpful too.
It can be freeing probably for them to not have such high expectations of themselves.
Right.
Well, we have a caller who has just written in a question, sorry, and I'm going to ask that to you if you're okay with that.
Sure.
It's Dean. He's writing in from Winnipeg. He says, my wife and I were both raised with strict rules in the household, and now we're recognizing patterns in our own home, but we want to change it. Can you offer any advice?
So I'm sorry. Will you read the recognizing patterns in our own home sentence one more time?
He said, we're recognizing some of those strict patterns in our own home, but we want to change it. Can you offer any advice?
Well, I think the advice I would offer, structure is great. It's great for kids knowing what their boundaries and rules are. That is all really positive. And yet it also, you want it to be balanced with grace and with love. And a home that has a lot of structure and a lot of love is the best home for kids. And that's what ultimately God has for us, right? He says, I love you no matter what you do. And by the way, here's how you should live your life, right?
Right.
An image I give in the book about this is our son William trying to transition out of his crib into a bed. And he just, once he got into a bed, he could not stay in the bed and he couldn't sleep as a result. So he was tired. We were tired. Everyone's cranky. And finally I said, William, this is at midnight. You know, what do you need to be able to go to sleep? And he said, Mom, I need a fence. And I think kids sometimes do need fences, which is to say that rules can be really positive for them. But the point of that fence is to give you a place where you can rest and be secure and be safe. And that's true for God's kind of rules and commands for us as well. It's like that we have God's loving embrace to hold us in that place through the structure that God gives us. So I think that all that is to say, I affirm structure and rules, but it has to be balanced by comfort and grace. And even I think for parents to admit to their children when the rules have gone too far, or, you know, or to say, and again, this depends on the age of your children, how much it's appropriate to have conversations about this. But we sometimes with our kids, we have a little family meeting and we'll say, okay, guys, as a family, we think we're watching too much TV. What are we going to do about that? And we usually have some suggestions, you know, but trying to get their input on that and help them recognize they're part of the solution for whatever problems our family's addressing. And then again, when we have gone too far, whether it's because we've been strict or because we've yelled at them or whatever it is, to say that we're sorry and to ask for their forgiveness, I think that is one way of helping to undo some negative patterns when families get into that rigidity and being too strict and not having the love to counterbalance that.
Dean, thanks so much for your question. We'll make sure to get you a copy of Amy Julia's book as well. You know, I read through your book and I get the feeling that songs or singing seems to be very important in your life and in raising your kids. I had a mom who was a singer and she was singing. She would sing sentences to us. She would sing to us when we woke up, good morning, good morning, good morning to you, constantly. And we were just like, oh, Mom, I can't stand that. But I find myself doing it all the time now with my kids.
Great.
And I'm just wondering, why did music play such a big part in your growing up? And of course, it has to do more with the songs that you sing your kids at night, I notice. So what part does music play for you?
You know, it is interesting to see how this has evolved. I also had a mom who, you know, would sing when we woke up and before we went to bed. So I do think that was part of my family background. And I was a singer in high school and helped lead worship in college. So I did have some of that in my own background, and I really enjoyed it. But I also think that singing is a point of comfort, and there is like a kind of a non-linear or not so rational aspect that comes out in just the beauty and the fun that can come from singing. And so I used to sing these different lullabies to our kids before they went to sleep. And then suddenly one night, I think it was William, he said, Mom, will you sing me a church song instead of that song you've been singing forever? And so I said, oh, sure. And so the next night he asked, the next night he asked, and then finally Penny started asking for the same thing. And so now they all just want the, and so I now sing them either hymns or praise songs every night. And they've each kind of landed on a favorite. We sometimes vary from that favorite. But it became just this real point of connection with my kids, but a connection that also invited God into that sleeping, you know, before we went to bed. And for me, even in some harrowing years spiritually, when I was just felt like I was falling apart on a spiritual level, I still, and so I wasn't praying very much and I wasn't reading the Bible and I was bitter and resentful about my lot in life as a parent. And yet I would come to the end of the day and I would sing these words of truth, you know, whatever, whether it was Amazing Grace or my son William loves a song from Isaiah 43. So singing about God's faithfulness, I will be with you, do not fear. Singing that over and over again, there's something very restorative to our soul. I think both the act of singing and certainly singing words from the Bible. So it's been a real gift to our family to have music as a part of it. And I think there are lots of reasons why, but those are some of them.
And I remember reading an article that what you do the 12 minutes before you go to sleep, you will retain the most while you're sleeping. Mm-hmm. And so if you're trying to memorize something, for example, that you should do it right before you go to sleep for those 10 or 12 minutes, and then it soaks into your brain. And so what a perfect way to put your kids to bed, but to sing them a hymn so that they're hearing those truths of God. It's brilliant.
Wow. Well, I can't claim any that brilliance was intentional, but that's really great to know.
It's purposeful and you didn't even know it. It's great when that happens where we do something right and we didn't even know it. Excellent. Well, Amy Julia, we have to take a quick break, but we will come back. And if we'll see if someone has a couple more questions. I certainly have a few more questions. So we will be right back talking to Amy Julia Becker about her book, Small Talk.
Well,
Welcome back to Connecting Faith. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. We're talking about small talk, things that our children say that help us learn more about them, more about ourselves, and more about God. And Amy Julia Becker is my guest today. She's written this fabulous book, and we'd love to put, we have one copy left. If you'd like to get a copy of that, we'd love to put that in your hands. You can give us a call at 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Amy Julia, you write a chapter called Laughter, and you write that you prayed at one point for laughter rather than patience. Why did you do that, and did it work out?
Thankfully, it did work out, and I got to a point, especially this is when William was really young, and he would not sleep. He didn't even take long naps during the day, and certainly at night, it was just a mess. And so for a long time, I prayed that he would sleep more, and he didn't. And so then I said that I would have patience, and I didn't. And so prayer just seemed like an exercise, either in, you know, futility, like God clearly doesn't want to answer this, or God isn't there, or I am, you know, not praying correctly or something like that. And I just was at the end of my rope. And it popped into my head, this something that an older Christian woman had said to me years earlier about a meeting that she ran. But she said, you know, I asked her why it went so well, this meeting that she ran. And she said, because I pray for laughter. And for whatever reason, God just put that in my head, to pray for laughter in our family, because it did, it felt too risky, honestly, to pray for him to sleep through the night or to pray for patience. And then he did eventually sleep through the night. And I don't know if I grew in patience. I hope I did. But I kept that prayer for a long time. It was the only thing I consistently prayed for our family, was that we would laugh together, because I do think there's a sense of that joy and delight that comes from God when a family laughs together. And so it was a way for me to see God's presence in our family life, even in the midst of some years of a lot of transitions. We moved, I think, 6 times over the course of 2 years, and that was really hard on me with all these little children. And so to pray for laughter in the midst of that gave me a sense of the delight and the joy that I think God wants for us and for our family. And it gave a sense of communion and enabled me to see the ways in which, like, my life became so messy, literally and figuratively, when I had kids. And to be able to let go and not feel like that was just me dropping things on the floor and creating a disaster zone, but let go in the sense of actually giving it over to God. I feel like praying for laughter somehow helped me to do that and to receive the joy that God has for us, even in the midst of some of that chaos and messiness. And so laughter, I don't actually have to pray for it that much anymore, because I recognize it when it comes, and our family's just in a more stable place than it was for all of those years of moving. But it was a really, it was a gift to pray that consistently and to find those moments and to hold on to them when laughter was what held us together as a family.
I was just at a baby shower, and we were supposed to write advice down on a little card as to what our motherly advice would be to this new mom. And someone wrote down, learn to laugh. God has a sense of humor, and always keep an extra set of clothes in your car.
That's great. I might have some baby wipes in the car, yep. But yeah.
It's all true. If you have an extra set of clothes for your children, then you can somehow laugh when the messiness happens, right?
Right. It'll all work out. Exactly.
It all works out.
Great.
So one of the most, I don't know if I'd call it a serious chapter as much that it really made me think, was your chapter on kindness. And you say that we can't really teach kindness. I mean, we spend all this time trying to teach our children to be kind, and yet it's not something that we can teach. Can you just unpack that a little bit, how you came to that conclusion?
Yeah, it took me a long time to come to that conclusion, but I realized that a lot of my life first of all, I guess I realized that my children are not innately kind, at least not to one another. I mean, sometimes they're very generous and wonderful with each other, but more often than not, they're fighting about who gets what and intentionally provoking and annoying each other. And that happens all the time. And so there is a need to intervene and to teach them manners and to teach them how to be nice to one another and to friends and things like that. And yet that true kindness it's a fruit of the Holy Spirit. It's not, which means that it only happens when God is actually active in our lives and the kindness comes flows out of that. And I realized that when I looked back at moments in my own life that seemed like I was being very, very kind, and yet I also know I was being very self-congratulatory for my kindness. And so I wanted my kids and myself to recognize the way that, the way that kindness comes, it's a gift from God that we get to give to other people. And so as I was praying about all of this and kind of realizing, gosh, I can't directly teach this to them, because again, it's a fruit of the Spirit. It's something that emerges from our relationship with God. It's not something that we can just come up with ourselves. And so I finally decided, okay, I can teach them maybe what's a foundation for kindness, some of those manners, and I can try to build on that. But I also can pray that for them. And it was really neat because in the midst of thinking about all of this, our kids were assigned prayer buddies in church, older people, men and women in church who would pray for them. And I was supposed to ask them, okay, well, what do you want, prayer for? And William said, I need to feel affirmed in, okay, that's what I need to do. I need to teach you manners and I need to teach you what's appropriate behavior. But all I can do is pray for you that the Spirit would be inside you and would be working, and that you would learn what it means and how it is by God's grace to be kind to other people.
I need that prayer, too. I need someone praying for me to constantly be kind because, boy, it does kind of fly out the window sometimes, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. These basic lessons, and yet they're simple and they're profound and necessary all the time.
Well, you responded to so many of your children's questions throughout the book, and yet you also wrote that it's nice to finally understand that it's impossible for moms or dads or parents to have all the answers and that that's okay. Talk more about that.
You know, I love it when my kids ask questions, and I love helping them try to answer it. And yet I do also, there are two things. I think one is just recognizing that I'm not the only source of wisdom or guidance in their life. Certainly there's my husband, but there also are people in our church. There are other family members, there are babysitters, there are friends. So there's lots of different people who can, whether it's like the simple question, you know, my mom can say which one is a sycamore tree and I cannot. So it might be something as basic as that, or more profound questions about, money or relationships or God. And it may be that I answer it one way and somebody else answers it another way, and that's good for our kids. Or it may be that we just have to say, yeah, I don't know the answer to that one. We're going to have to think about it together. And there's some freedom in not having to have all the answers and in showing our kids that as they grow up, again, you want to give them enough security so that they don't feel like the whole world is one big question mark. But at the same time, to know that there's freedom in not knowing everything, yet being able to trust that you are safe and secure and loved all the same.
How about being generous? Do you have conversations with your kids about being generous? That seems like another thing that can't exactly be taught.
Yes, and I try to acknowledge when they are generous. So in the rare moment when instead of fighting over something, one of them, spontaneously gives to the other one, I try to make a point of saying it was so generous when you, whatever it was, so that at least I'm acknowledging that that happened and that that's positive, and they're getting some kind of affirmation for it. And then we also try to model generosity, whether it's with the simple things like let's bring soup to church because people need it who are hungry, or guys, we're going to give some clothing away, or we're going to give some money away, and talking about who might need that. So I think modeling generosity, and that's not, again, not just like, oh, we have old clothes that we want to get rid of, but actual generosity, trying to show them that can help as well with that one.
Well, Amy Julia, we are going to have to say goodbye. I wanted to thank you so much for just sharing your insight and helping us to look at our children as being little wise people that can help us in our walk with God as well. So thanks so much for sharing all your insights with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, you too. Her book is called Small Talk, Learning from My Children About What Matters Most. We'll have a link to be able to get that book, of course. It looks like we've given away the ones that we have. Amy Julia Becker, though, I'm sure you can get her. You have a website, correct?
I do. It's amyjuliabecker.com.
Okay. Well, very simple then. We'll have a link to that on our website as well. Thanks so much for listening to Connecting Faith today. Have a wonderful weekend.